From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Captain Francesco Schettino has got to be just about the most mocked and disgraced man on Earth this week. As press reports have it, Schettino ran his ship, the cruise liner Costa Concordia, onto the rocks off the Italian Isle of Giglio while flirting with a pretty passenger, leaped into a lifeboat, and abandoned over 4,000 souls to their fates. Not exactly in the great tradition of brave sea captains staying with their ships to the end, but then not all have been brave. This hour, On Point, captains and their ships in trouble at sea. The ones who stayed, the ones who fled, you can join the conversation. What do you make of the captain who tripped and fell in a lifeboat? Sea captains, sailors, landlubbers, what do you make of this story? What should the standard be? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Rome in Italy is Stacey Miketree, Rome correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Stacey, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
First of all, what's the latest on the status of the ship and the death and missing toll there?
Well, they've suspended the search for 21 missing people. The reason being that the ship has been sort of shifting on the sea base, and this is creating problems for the the safety of the rescue workers. We also need to keep in mind that inside the belly of the boat is about 2,300 tons of fuel. So there's also a big environmental risk.
And the ship itself, is it in danger of going deeper into the sea? Could it disappear? Are we going to be looking at this carcass lying near the surface forever?
Well, right now it's basically perched on a ledge of seabed, and it has about 10 meters to go before it reaches the edge. So, yes, I mean, if it slides another 10 meters, we likely will see the ship disappear, although, Italian authorities are taking measures to try to prop it up in place right now.
What about the captain, Captain Schettino? We're talking about captains this hour. What's his status now?
Well, his lawyer issued a statement this morning saying that, first of all, he's under house arrest right now. The lawyer wants to see that end. He wants to see him released. One of the reasons they're making this request is that the judge, in placing him under arrest, based her ruling on the idea that we need to keep him detained so that he doesn't go back to work. This was basically the only rationale behind the decision. What happened yesterday is that the company formally suspended him. So from the point of view of his lawyer, there's no more risk for him to go back to work. So why not let him free?
What charges will he face?
Well, he's facing preliminary charges of multiple manslaughter for the 11 deaths so far. He's also brought up on charges for abandonment of ship and a failure to assist passengers in need.
Now, you say 11 deaths, but then there's 21 missing. Does that mean this could rise to 11 plus 21 dead?
I think we have to take that into consideration at this point. We're now 7 days into the crisis, and it's hard to imagine that survivors could still be inside the boat at this point. We're talking about 7 days without food and water.
Stacey, what about the company that owns this boat? It's a company that's part of the Carnival Cruise Line conglomerate, I guess. What do we know about the role that the corporate sort of masters here played, maybe on the telephone with this captain as the ship was going down?
Yeah, well, we know that the operator of the ship, it's called Costa Crociere. They were on the phone with the captain. They spoke to him before he spoke to Coast Guards. They also kept on speaking to him as 78 minutes passed before he actually sounded the evacuation alarm. So it does sort of raise questions as to what sort of advice, if any, he was receiving from the people at headquarters. Now, keep in mind that the operator is a unit of Carnival Corp. So it isn't really clear what sort of direct authority or oversight Carnival would be exercising over the operator in a situation like this.
You've been watching this closely from right there in Italy. You know the kind of headlines that this captain is getting around the world, chicken of the sea, you know, the most disparaging possible sort of a presentation of him. Does that seem fair to your eyes, Stacey? Is he being scapegoated here somehow, or is this man just proven himself disastrous as a captain?
Well, luckily I'm just a journalist, not a judge and jury. But, you know, certainly the Italian press has been raking him over the coals. He's sort of been branded a national villain or a symbol of cowardice here. Whereas you know, there's a Coast Guard captain who, you know, upbraided him over the phone. And this man, Gregorio De Falco, has sort of been put up there and lionized as a national hero. So you have this sort of duality between those two figures.
And is it a crime in Italian law for the captain to abandon a sinking ship before the passengers?
It is. You know, it's not just an Italian law, but it's sort of a law of the sea. You're supposed to be the last one on board when the ship goes down, or at least the last one to leave the ship. It definitely looks like there was some serious negligence here.
Law of the sea may be more a matter of tradition than of legal bite, but we'll look at that in this hour. Stacey Miketree with the Wall Street Journal in Rome, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Here's some of that tape heard around the world. Captain Schettino getting a humiliating dressing down and being ordered amid curses by an Italian Coast Guard captain to reboard the Costa Concordia and supervise the ship's evacuation.
Captain, this is an order. Now I am in charge. Get back on that ship and coordinate the operations. There are already casualties. Captain, how many? Port Authority, you should tell me that. What do you want to do, go home? Now you get back on that ship and tell us what can be done. How many people are still there and what do they need? Captain, okay, I am going.
Okay, I'm going, but he didn't. Said he tripped and fell in a lifeboat to kick it all off and then was supervising from off the ship. He was not back on that boat. And you hear there's outrage in the Coast Guard voice there, people around the world looking at this and saying, what is going on? How does this or does this not fit into the great history of maritime, of sea captains? We're going to look at that in this hour. Joining me in the studio right now is William Bill Fowler, professor of maritime history at Northeastern University, author of plenty of books on maritime history, including Under Two Flags and Jack Tars and Commodores, also co-author of America and the Sea. Bill Fowler, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
And with us from London, Sam Willis, maritime historian, archaeologist, sailor, author of a number of books himself on crews and captains, including Gloria's First of June and Shipwreck, A History of Disasters at Sea, fellow in the Royal Historical Society. Sam Willis in London, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm pleased to be here.
Sam, let me come first to you. Just looking at what we've seen over the last week, just off the coast of Italy with this ship and this captain, does this look like an outrageous lapse in terms of maritime history and expectation to you, Sam?
Well, very much so. I think we need to understand, first of all, the rarity of the situation. I mean, these ships don't go down very often. And when we do, we really focus on what has happened. But throughout history, there are examples, very famous examples of captains staying with their ship. But there were also equal number of examples of captains abandoning their ship. So it's certainly not a one-off in the broad history of shipwrecks.
Bill Fowler, William Fowler, as you look at this particular story, and we've all watched it like few before, I mean, the images, just to start with, a cruise line of this size going down, you never think that's going to happen. And then a captain seemingly so cavalierly off as the poor passengers are trying to rappel down over the huge hull of this ship, and here he is off somewhere else. What are you thinking as you watch this unfold, Bill?
Well, I think first we need to be a little cautious. I agree with Sam that this sort of thing does appear to be outrageous, but there'll be thorough investigations to come, and we'll know much more about the captain's conduct. On the face of it, clearly he seems to have abandoned the ship. How that happened and what he intended to do, I think, is yet to be made clear to us. But clearly, from the initial reports, Captain Schettino behaved very poorly.
Is there a circumstance in which it's all right by maritime tradition for the captain to be off the ship when 4,000 passengers are still on it and it's going down?
Well, I would like to suggest one might think of a scenario in this example where the ship began to list rather dramatically, and we can see from the photographs.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, the bridge was no longer operable. That would not have been the best place to oversee rescue operations.
Because it's at such an angle.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. So perhaps, and again, I'm only only speculating here. Perhaps control from shore might have been more advantageous and more practical. But I don't know that that was the captain's intent. If that was the captain's intent, to immediately go ashore so that he could better coordinate rescue efforts, then I think we need to consider that. If, on the other hand, he was just fleeing the vessel, that's entirely different.
It wouldn't be the first time the captain has argued, and we'll hear about it, that he's better off the ship coordinating the exit of passengers. But,
yes.
Bill, you heard that Coast Guard commander saying, get your hinder back on that vessel.
But remember, the Coast Guard commander is not on the vessel. He's observing, too, from a distance. Some years ago, in the early 1990s, there was an example of a vessel that began to sink off the coast of South Africa. And the captain gave the abandoned ship order. He abandoned the ship.
Well, passengers, hold that thought right there. We'll come back and hear the story in full. We're talking this hour about captains and their ships in trouble through history, the ones who stayed, the ones who fled. Sam Willis, please stand by in London. And William Fowler, great to have you with us right here. There are press reports that, unbelievably, Celine Dion's tribute to the Titanic, My Heart Will Go On, had been playing in the dining room of the Costa Concordia just before it began to sink off the Italian coast on January 13th. We'll go out with that song and a little echo of Titanic in our minds. And, of course, our thoughts with the souls of all those lost on this down ship. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about captains and their ships in trouble through history. The captains who stayed, the captains who fled. In this week's strange, alarming case of the cruise ship, the Costa Concordia, and its captain, far from the ship itself, as thousands of passengers struggled to get themselves to safety. I'm joined in the studio today by William Fowler, professor of maritime history at Northeastern University, and from London by Sam Willis, maritime historian, archaeologist, sailor, and fellow in the Royal Historical Society there. He helped to sail a replica of Shackleton's Endurance into an ice pack for the filming of the British TV film Shackleton. Joins us from London today. Bill, you were just telling us the story of the ship off of South Africa. I think this was about 1991.
Correct.
And what happened there?
Well, the captain gave the command to abandon ship, and he later...
Was it going down?
The ship was going down.
Taking on water?
So he ordered abandon ship, and then later he recounted that when he gave the order to abandon ship, he meant it for everyone, including himself. And so he left, shall we say, prematurely. The ship did go down. Most of the passengers, I believe all of the passengers, were in fact rescued. Later in a court of inquiry, he was cleared. So again, it's difficult to tell immediately after an event like this. I'm not certainly defending the captain of Oceanus or captain of Costa Concordia, but I think we do need to be somewhat cautious here before we rush to some judgment.
You can hear, this is a story where I think there were 571 aboard eventually saved, but hundreds were still on board when he left. A magician and guitarist from the ship's entertainment crew took over the bridge, calling the mayday and helping hundreds of terrified passengers off that rapidly sinking ship. This is the Oceanos, 1991. Here's a little bit of the captain in a documentary later, but here he was, astonishingly unrepentant.
When I order abandon the ship, as a matter of time I live. Abandon is for everybody. If something they like to stay, they can stay.
Incredible. When I order abandon ship, it doesn't matter what time I leave. Abandon is for everybody. If some people like to stay, they can stay. Now, Sam Willis, he may have been cleared in the end, but does that square with anything in maritime history, Sam?
No, there's a certain degree of moral expectation, I think, for the captain to stay and to oversee the evacuation. And I think we need to be very much aware that circumstances can change so dramatically on a sinking ship. And you need someone to be aware of exactly how those circumstances can change to help coordinate with the authorities ashore. So, that example there, I've not heard a parallel of at all.
Here's a question that people are asking online, and it goes to the sort of what's behind all the expectations here. Tanner asks, is going down with the ship, or you might say, you know, staying on till everybody else is off, is it actual, is it a rule, is it policy, or is it some kind of unwritten romantic era act of honor? What is it, Bill Fowler?
Well, the master of a vessel, the captain, has enormous power, enormous authority, almost absolute in many cases. With that authority goes great responsibility. And the responsibility is to see to the safety of the vessel, the passengers, and the cargo.
Mm-hmm.
So that is his or her responsibility. It is not written that he or she must go down with the ship.
Mm-hmm.
But by tradition, it is expected that the captain will see to the safety of, again, of those three elements before the captain abandons the vessel. So the law itself, there is no international law that says the captain must stay with the vessel or the captain must go down with the ship. But it is an expectation of tradition, and it is a moral responsibility that he or she see to the safety of those who have been given into his care.
Sam Willis in London, is that your understanding of international maritime law? No written in stone law that the captain stay?
Yes, that's how I understand it. But I also think it's important to make a distinction between a merchant navy and a navy, on the basis that certainly throughout history there have been examples of captains of naval ships who are happier to go down with their ship rather than face the dishonor of losing that ship. They were happier for the ship to be destroyed rather than handed over to the enemy, because a warship is an asset which can then get passed over to a different navy, which could then change the whole dimension of a sort of a strategic situation. So the examples that I know of, the captains that have gone down with the ships are much more likely to be associated with naval vessels than they are with merchant naval vessels.
What's the origin of the captain goes off last here, or staying with the ship, Bill? Where does that come from? Is it just a matter of honor and care, or is there an economic imperative here?
Well, certainly there is an economic imperative, because there's the law of salvage. And that is that once a vessel is completely abandoned and becomes derelict, she's a fair game for anyone to come and try to salvage her. So the captain staying aboard, or some officer staying aboard, retains ownership. He or she is speaking on behalf of the owner of the vessel. So that very basic business economic decision. And then, as Sam mentioned, we get into the moral and ethical responsibility that the captain has to stay aboard to see to the saving of his vessel until the last minute. Going down with the ship, and again, Sam mentions this in the naval tradition, clearly, a naval officer going down with his ship might often make that choice rather than to surrender and then suffer disgrace. But the master of a merchant vessel is not under that kind of command.
Of course, we've read about this in great works of fiction. Joseph Conrad's Lord Jim has the infamous episode there where the captain is hardly the model of rectitude. But then it turns out there's a real-life story, the SS Jeddah, the inspiration for that. This was 1880. Like the fictional seaman, there's a Captain Joseph Clark and his crew abandoned the Jeddah, convinced that the leaking ship would have sunk. It had nearly 1,000 passengers on it, Muslim pilgrims on the way to Mecca, left to their fate in the Bay of Bengal. He reported the ship lost, but then it showed up in port. How bad could he possibly look? I mean, that's about as bad as it gets, and yet there it was. We've got a lot of callers. Yorktown, Virginia, Seth is calling. Hi, Seth, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to share a story with you all today. My grandfather was a captain of a Coast Guard ship that capsized, was hit by a much larger trader ship. A little controversy there. He was destined to stay at the ship. He was actually rescued by another crew member when some other crew members didn't make it out alive. Pretty big controversy there. He was willing to stay at the ship. So it's pretty crazy story. Happened before I was even born.
But, how did he look back on that story in later years, Seth?
He obviously didn't feel good about the situation. And the whole fault issue was blamed on multiple people, never really resolved as his fault. I mean, obviously being the captain, he was in charge of the vessel. But like I said, it wasn't like he didn't feel that. I mean, he felt bad, obviously, for the people.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah. Seth, thanks for that story. One more here. Rockport, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show. Another egregious example of captain cowardice. Closer to home here in Massachusetts, right off of the coast of Cohasset, back in 1849, there was an Irish famine ship with over 100 people on board, and they anchored in the teeth of a nor'easter off the shore of Cohasset, and the anchors dragged, I guess, and the ship ended up on the rocks and started to pound to pieces. Unfortunately, I guess the 99 of the passengers were locked in the hold.
Wow.
And the captain and crew took off on a lifeboat and rowed ashore to Cohasset. So you can only imagine what it must have been like in that hold as the ship was pounded to pieces on the rocks. But so, you know, maybe a captain shouldn't have to go down with the ship. But certainly there's some, you know,
take care of the passengers before you bolt. Yeah, a story of infamy there, again, Bill Fowler. Mm-hmm. Of course, these are up against stories of people who did anything and everything to try and help the passengers on board. Give us some example on that side of the ledger.
Well, in many times in catastrophes like this, the first casualty is discipline, and that is that the discipline of the crew. We depend, as passengers and sailing aboard these vessels, we depend upon the crew being able to serve us and protect us. And as the caller just mentioned, the example off the coast of Cohasset was an example of where the crew fell into disarray. That was also true. There was an earlier example in 1854. The American steamship Baltic was charging across the North Atlantic at a reckless speed, by the way, traveling through fog, and it is, again, reckless behavior, encountered and collided with another vessel, and the Arctic began to sink, and she sank over several hours. And the crew took to the rafts, completely ignoring the passengers and, in fact, brushing the passengers aside. So, again, discipline broke down. In that particular instance of the Arctic, the captain did, in fact, go down with the ship. But maintaining discipline in that time of stress like this is absolutely essential. And when that discipline breaks down, everyone is in danger.
It's not as though it hasn't been done. Here's a little tape from a very famous story, and it's this was Christmas night, 1951, New York flagged freighter, the SS Flying Enterprise, ran into a storm off the coast of Ireland, foundered for 17 days before finally sinking. Her Danish captain, Henrik Kurt Carlsen, stayed till the very end, became an international hero, as you can hear from this old newsreel.
A 15-day battle of men against the sea enters its final phase, as the freighter Flying Enterprise lies dead in the water at the mercy of the raging Atlantic. Listing at an 80-degree angle, the ship remains in the custody of her heroic skipper, Henrik Kurt Carlsen, who clung to his post through days and nights of howling winter gales. Within 30 miles of the British coast, after the tow line had snapped, the sea strikes with renewed fury, and the valiant skipper and his ship are helpless victims of mountainous seas.
Mountainous seas and days on that boat and not giving it up. And in those days, that called for, well, in his case, a ticker tape parade and Medal of Honor in New York City. This is the opposite of Captain Scatino these days.
Accompanied by Mrs. Carlson and daughters Sonia and Karen, the stocky 37-year-old Danish-born square-jawed sea dog runs into a new storm, a paper one, as New York opens its heart to him. A few days ago, drenched to the skin, Carlson was living on pound cake and wine and sleeping on the tilted cabin wall of his ill-fated ship. Now, at City Hall, aboard a replica of the Enterprise's stern, Mayor Impellitteri awards him New York's Medal of Honor, and Carlson says he'll go back to sea.
Now, there's your square-jawed sea dog hero. Sam Willis is also, of course, the famous story of the Birkenhead. Can you recount some of that for us, Sam?
The Birkenhead's a very interesting one. It actually raises another point that a lot of these wrecks we've been hearing about have been in the 19th century when ships were started to be made of iron and later on of steel, because wooden ships don't sink anything like as fast as iron ships.
Yeah.
The Birkenhead was an iron ship, 1862, carrying troops and some passengers, and she went down off the coast of South Africa. And what happened is that the lifeboats had not been maintained. They were rusted to their davits, so they couldn't be moved. Only a few were available to be moved.
A troop ship that also had families, women and children of the sailors, I think, on board.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And people are going to South Africa with them. Mm-hmm. And they had to decide who was going to get on first. So there was this strict rule of women and children first. And it works to a certain extent in that wreck, but once you look into it, you discover that all of the men actually stood in line because they had muskets and bayonets pointed at them. So there was a certain amount of compulsion for them to behave themselves.
Well, wait a minute. The famous story is that they sort of just had the stiff upper lip and sort of stood and watched the women and children go off, but they were doing that at that gunpoint, you're saying?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the story was used by the Kaiser to tell his troops in the First World War. It was a classic example of manly courage. There was even a little poem written about it that said, "I've an English ship and an English crew who've always pulled together, who to each other have been true in fair and stormy weather, their duty they will not shirk from now that they know the worst. So lower the boats, but remember, lads, it's the women and children first.
Women but and the children more we, first, yeah.
The more we know about this, we're starting to find out that there's a complete sort of element of chaos when ships go down, and these sort of overly romantic views of it do not necessarily tally with the reality. The story is almost better than what happened on that day.
Well, you peel back the layers in history, and it very often gets more complicated. I mean, there's the moral call to do the right thing. The Titanic went down. The captain there, as it's been handed down to us, Bill Fowler, admonishing his men to be British and let the women and children leave first.
Yes.
But in that case, I mean, look at the numbers. 74% of the women on the Titanic survived. 52% of the children were saved. Only 20% of the men. Somebody was paying attention to that admonition.
Yes, indeed, they were. About 1,500 people went down on the Titanic, including, as you mentioned, Captain Smith. There was also associated with the sink of the Titanic a story similar to the one we're talking about today. One person, one of the men who was saved, was in fact the chairman of the board of the corporation that owned the Titanic.
Mm-hmm. His name beat the odds somehow.
Well, his name was J. Bruce Ismay was mm-hmm. his name. And Mr. Ismay, later there were a variety of stories, but one of the stories that Mr. Ismay said was he fell into the lifeboat. Sounds all so familiar. And so Mr. Ismay was saved and then spent the rest of his life, by the way, in absolute infamy.
Because he got off that ship when so many others did not. Kim in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Kim, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
My great-grandfather went down on the Titanic, and his son, he'd gotten separated with, ended up jumping off the back of the Titanic and living. He jumped off the back with this kid named Milton Long. They were both about 17 years old. And he managed to get to an overturned life raft where about 22 men had found their way there and knelt on one on top of each other to survive the night. And whether it was Bruce Ismay or the captain that were pretty much shell-shocked and ruined the rest of their lives, I don't know. But they all listened to the thousands of people drowning and dying around them. And my great-uncle, my great-grandfather's son, 17 years old, was brought to speak to, I'm not sure if it was Ismay or the captain, because they'd gotten into a fairly catatonic state of being unable to speak about it weeks after the event. And he said that he noticed that the man's hair had turned white overnight, and that he had no response, no ability to get any words out of him. So not only did they live in infamy, I think they lived in horror. That night.
One can only imagine. I mean, the responsibility there, but Ismay fleeing early. The captain, though, Bill Fowler, goes down is sort of an archetype of the way it's supposed to be done, apart from hitting the iceberg.
Oh, the captain of the Titanic was almost sent from central casting, a very distinguished, very experienced captain with White Star, made the perfect image of a British officer. And indeed, the story is told that his words to his crew were, "Be British, be British." And I think in this particular instance, from the accounts that we have, the crew of the Titanic, the White Star Line crew, did indeed behave as proper British, proper seamen.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about captains and their ships, the ones who stayed when things got rough, the ones who fled, and this week's strange, alarming case of the big cruise ship we've all seen now, the Costa Concordia, on its side, the captain far off. You can join the conversation this hour. Did you just assume the captain would be, should be, the last one off a sinking ship? And would you have the guts to do it? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. William Fowler is with us from Northeastern University, author of Under Two Flags and Jack Tars and Commodores. With us from London today, maritime historian and archaeologist Sam Willis, author of Shipwreck, A History of Disasters at Sea. A little tape here from what we've seen over the last week. As the ship there, the Costa Concordia, foundered on the rocks, the power went out. Confused passengers stood in the hallways outside their berths. Members of the crew made vague, reassuring announcements in several languages. A German passenger turned on his video camera as the announcements began. You'll notice the very beginning of the English announcement is missing.
On behalf of the captain, to inform you that due to an electrical fault, which is currently under control, we're currently in a blackout. Our technicians are working to resolve the situation, and we'll inform you of developments as they occur. Thank you for your attention.
Under control. Yeah, not really. Here's a passenger, Jesus Garcia, back in the U.S. at Miami International Airport after his ordeal on the Costa Concordia, thanks to WSVN for this audio.
The captain stays towards till the end. He's the last one to leave, and he never did. He was the first one to leave. We never saw him on land, never, at no point in time.
At no point in time, passenger Maria Papa spoke to NBC's Today Show about her harrowing experience on the Costa Concordia as it was taking on water and leaning into the rocks.
It's a very scary feeling. At one point, I actually seen a bunch of crew members running past, and there was about 15 or 20 of them. And I said to my daughter, "Is that the captain?" And she's like, "Mom, I don't think so."
Is that the captain running by? Pat in Boston, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
I worked for a large American cruise ship company as a musician for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, every crew member on these big boats now is required to be part of the ship evacuation drill. We call it the boat drill, and we did it at the beginning of each cruise, usually about twice a week. And there was a lot of gallows humor, at least among the entertainers, about what would happen if it ever came to pass as it did on the Concordia. And we had an Italian crew, and I'd say two of the three captains I had no confidence in.
Two of the three captains you had no confidence. You just had the sense that if the chips were down, they would not be there for the ship, for the crew, for the passengers.
Nobody knew. Nobody wanted to find out.
That's pretty wild. I mean, Bill Fowler, you and I think both, Sam Willis, you guys sometimes lecture on board cruise ships. Because there's an audience for stories like these in that setting that nobody wants to go down. Do you see, I'll come first to you, Bill, do you see a cultural problem, a discipline problem on these ships, which is perhaps all too easy to see as just giant floating hotels, never mind the rules of the sea?
I think there's always that potential in these large vessels because you have multinational crews. And when orders are being given, it may not always be clear what the order is and how it's being received. One thing that I always do, and I've sailed for many, many years on cruise ships, on dozens and dozens of them, I do the same thing on a cruise ship that I do when I enter into a large auditorium to listen to a rock concert. That is, I look for the exits. And I would advise people, just as a matter of common sense, that when you go aboard a vessel, it's an alien environment to you. Pay special attention yourself. Don't wait for the drills and all that. Pay special attention to walk about, notice where the life jackets are, and notice your routes of escape.
When you say the exit, you don't mean just from the ballroom room you're in or the dining room, or do you mean that, as well as from which deck you would want to make your...
Absolutely. I think that if you're staying overnight in a big hotel in Boston or New York, it can be a very confusing environment. And keep in mind, too, that when you need to get out, it won't be easy. There could be smoke. There could be a lack of electrical power, as we have here. So I really do believe that it's incumbent upon people, and I'm... to make sure that when you go aboard a vessel like this that you walk about and see where the exits are and become accustomed and familiar with those things.
Sam Willis, we all saw that amazing video, and I should say, by the way, there's some terrific, really interesting video on our website of a gallery of videos of sinking ships and what's going on there. You should check it out. But on the Costa Concordia, with the captain nowhere in sight as far as we can tell, and the ship really looking like a beached whale there practically on the rocks, you see passengers milling around on the side of the hull and trying to get hold of, I guess, a rope and sort of rappel down the side of that ship. I mean, it looks really challenging to get off, even if you're ready and willing to try and do it, Sam.
Yeah, there are a couple of things here. We'll pick up on what Bill said. When you go on a cruise ship, I mean, there are thousands of people on board, so mm-hmm. maybe 6,500 on the biggest ones, and that actually puts you in a situation of danger because humans, you're naturally pack animals. We're very good at innovating occasionally, and we'll change things, but we're much better at copying everyone else.
Yep.
And once you go onto these ships, you have to become aware of that, and actually being around that many people makes you vulnerable. There's a lot of work going on in crisis management to do with this. And one example is the King's Cross fire in London, where there was an underground fire. And there are videos of smoke pouring out of the underground stations with people carrying on, oblivious, still going down the escalators to get on the underground. They just do what they normally do. They don't really pay attention to what's happening. And you're very vulnerable in a big group of people to that happening to you. So you have to... There are very few of us who think outside the box, who say, actually, we need to be doing this, we need to be doing that right now. Now, the problem is that however much you get trained for such a crisis situation, it's very much a personal thing, whether or not you can cope when the pressure's on. And I read a very interesting thing saying that the captain was seen in an almost a catatonic state, and he'd completely lost all focus and all control. And there are numerous examples of that happening to captains who are otherwise extremely competent people. But when something happens, they just stop working. Their brains cut out.
But they're the ones who are supposed to be experienced and on top of it because they should have thought through it so often. I mean, as a passenger, I've been through those drills where you're practicing the evacuation. But in those practices, everyone's standing in neat ranks on a very level ship with the lifeboats right in front of you. It's all calm and happy. In chaos, when things are rolling and on their side, could be a different story. Bridgewater, Virginia. Mike, you're on the air. Mike, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'll try to make this quick. When the ship gets a hole in it, usually that side of the ship goes down. We've all seen photographs of the damage to the ship with the rock stuck in the hole.
Mm-hmm.
That's sticking out of the water. The ship rolled once and then rolled the other way for some reason. I believe the reason is called the free surface effect. Mm-hmm. Take an ice tray with water in it, not ice, hold it over your sink. If it's got the divider in, tilt the ice tray,
yeah,
and the water stays normally in place. Pull out that divider, tilt the tray, and you got water all over the place. I believe the ship hit the rock, it tore a hole in the ship, and then what's called free surface effect, that is when the divider is out of the ice cube tray, free surface effect took place for some reason.
Does that diminish the captain's responsibility in any way, Mike, for the rock strike or for his behavior after the ship was listing and going down?
Maintenance. As far as I know, I'm retired Navy, but I'm not a merchant marine sailor. I believe that the captain is responsible for the maintenance of the ship, and either by design or through bad maintenance, that ship suffered a free surface defect problem.
Mike, let us pick it up. Bill Fowler, can you see some way in which maintenance might have saved this ship once it hit those rocks?
No, I don't really think that would be the case, Tom. I mean, all of these vessels are carefully inspected. I mean, this is a major corporation. I think we can, well, and we will find out,
well,
certainly.
Well, I mean, we don't presume anything anymore. The major corporations, we've seen all kinds of lapses in corporations of all sizes, I have to say.
But these vessels are inspected on a regular basis. So I would be doubtful that there was anything of that nature. I think from a point of inquiry, there are two questions that I would want to ask.
Mm-hmm.
One would have to do with navigation. Why did the ship alter course? That's a fundamental question.
Now, we've heard that this ship had been cleared for this same path, this same route, 6 months or a year earlier, right, by the controlling company.
Well, the rock didn't show up during the interim.
Yeah.
So we need to know that.
Mm-hmm.
The second question I would have is, why did it take so long, it would appear,
mm-hmm.
to sound the abandoned ship alarm? It's the most precious commodity you have in a situation like this is time, and there was time wasted.
Well, there are reports the captain was still ordering dinner after this thing was going down.
I think that is a crucial question because you need time to evacuate the vessel, and they lost time. This vessel didn't immediately go over at a 30 or 40 degree angle. It took some time for that to happen,
mm-hmm.
and that was the time that should have been used. I don't know why the alarm wasn't sounded earlier. That video that you have, that tape that you have, that everything is under control, of course, when it's dark outside, everything's not under control.
Yeah. Sam Willis, what do you make of the very, very long delay before things really got tightened up here and underway?
Well, I'm interested in this question of time, and it's also linked with the question of free surface effect, which the previous caller talked about. When free surface effect takes hold, it speeds up the act of sinking, the act of listing. Some of the most famous wrecks, like the Mary Rose is one, or the Royal George, which went down in 1782, they both suffered from free surface effect with water pouring in through open gun ports. Now, essentially what's happened is they've created like a massive gun port on the side of their ship by ripping a hole in it. Now, with the water pouring in, that would have dramatically increased the speed at which the ship would have listed. Now, that raises the question of, again, why did it take so long? And it also perhaps will help us understand and explain why some of these passengers so tragically got trapped in the hull if water was pouring in at a very rapid rate.
John in Glasgow, Kentucky. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
As a teenager, I read a book about the collision of the Italian liner, the Andrea Doria, and the Swedish liner, the Stockholm. And as I recall in the book, the Italian crew was chaotic, disorganized. The Swedish crew was very efficient. And I just wonder if the experts can draw any parallels to the behavior of the Italian crew on the Andrea Doria in this most recent event.
Well, let's
hang up and listen to the answer.
Okay, John, thank you. Let's tread carefully on our old north-south divide here. But Bill Fowler, what about the are there patterns of cultural reaction in the sinking of a ship? And I'll come to you, Sam, as well. We might extend this all the way across the Pacific. But what about the example our caller raises?
I think the only pattern that I could discern in this sort of thing is the pattern of the training of the officers in command and how they indeed train their own crews. I don't think it has much to do with nationality, but it certainly has a lot to do with training, and maintaining discipline. In nearly every instance that we've been talking about so far, there seems to have been the word chaos that comes into play. And that is chaos that comes from the undiscipline of the crew. So I don't think there's any particular national traits, but it really does have to do with training.
Sam, take us maybe to the story of the Japanese battleship, the Yamato.
Well, can I just start with something else?
Because
opened up a really interesting strand of conversation. The different nationalities, it's something that was certainly seized on in history, an idea of national superiority. The British took a lot of pride in the fact that they thought they were better in a shipwreck, whether they were or not. And they thought the French were notoriously useless. And there's a very interesting example. After the war, Winston Churchill chose to go on an Italian ship. And he was interviewed by a journalist from a New York paper. And they said, "Why have you chosen an Italian ship?" And he said, "Well, there are three things I like about Italian ships. First, their cuisine, which is unsurpassed. Second, their service, which is quite superb. And then, in the time of emergency, there's none of this nonsense about women and children going first."
Oh my. Okay. Thank you, Churchill. Wow.
And there are other examples. A very interesting one from just after the Napoleonic Wars, the wreck of the Medusa, which was the ship was abandoned by her officers and crew, who took the boats, leaving all the passengers on a raft only 68 feet long. They then towed them towards the coast of Africa. And when they got to within sight of the coast, they cut the ropes, and the raft drifted off across the horizon, and it was discovered 2 weeks later.
This all the way back to 1816, and there's all kinds of murder and even cannibalism after they left all the passengers on the raft behind.
That's right. And the British press loved it because it was a perfect example of what was wrong with France. It was like, this is how the French people behave in a shipwreck. So whether or not it's true is not necessarily the question, but it has been interpreted in the past as very much being a question of nationality, particularly by the British. But as we know from the Birkenhead story we discussed earlier, we now know that those troops were held there at gunpoint. So it's much more complex than we think.
And the Japanese battleship, the Yamato?
Yeah, that was the Yamato in 1945, so that was just before the Americans were about to invade Okinawa, before the invasion of Japan itself. The Yamato was the largest battleship that had ever been built, and what they wanted to do was to take her out to sea and draw away the American carriers, while the kamikazes could then attack the American troops on Okinawa. The problem was is that they didn't have any air cover at all for the Yamato, and she was going to go down, and her captain, Arrigo, knew knew they were going to go down, and he had himself physically tied to the ship's binnacle, in which was the compass, the symbol of navigation.
Wow.
He had another sailor tie himself to that to make sure that he was going to go down with his ship. It was very much a part of Japanese culture. They celebrated an example of a Russian captain, a Russian admiral, Makarov, who went down in a Russian destroyer in 1904 off Port Arthur, which was being besieged by the Japanese. And there are lots of very famous Japanese prints showing the heroic Admiral Makarov with his huge forked beard going down on his ship. So for them, it was very much part of their culture. It was a heroic death to be embraced, very much like the kamikaze themselves.
Admirable dedication. I don't know if I want my captain actually tied. I like him ready to act and help at the same time. But it's incredible dedication right there. Bill Fowler, how do you think a story like this sort of goes into maritime history now? Will this stand as a sort of counterexample to buck up ship's captains and say, you don't want to be that poor, disgraced Scatino who's skedaddled?
I think one of the lessons here is a lesson we've heard and learned time and time and time again. A colleague of mine is fond of saying everything was okay until we added people. And this is an example of that, where we depend upon technology, modern vessels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of the electronic equipment that was on board the ship, the redundant systems, and I'm sure that as the investigation goes forward, we'll see that she was, in quotation marks, a state-of-the-art vessel.
Yep.
All of that was there. But then someone made a very big mistake. And that is often the case, so often the case in tragedies at sea. We depend upon technology, we depend upon the vessel, et cetera, and then the captain or whoever is in command makes a tragic and terrible mistake.
And here we have it, and already 11 confirmed dead, 21 missing, the whole world watching this great cruise liner floundered on its side there off the coast of Italy. And the captain, not in much good standing at this moment, will watch as the story of what happened there unfolds. Sam Willis, joining us today from London, author of Shipwreck. Great to have you with us today. Sam, thank you so much for your time and insights.
Thank you for inviting me.
And William Fowler, author of Under Two Flags and Jack Tars and Commodores, professor of maritime history at Northeastern University. Wonderful to have you right here today, Bill. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
Good sailing, everybody. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.